Greetings, programs, and welcome to the latest edition of the Awesome Friday podcast. Coming at you this week from the Vancouver International Film Festival, my name is Matthew, and with me, as always, is Simon. Say hello, Simon.
Well, hello, everyone, and how lovely it is to see you again. It's interesting, this week, regular listeners can play the game of whose voice is ruined this week.
That's right, folks, it's cold and flu season here in Vancouver.
So we missed last week because someone didn't get us the things that they were meant to get us. So we had nothing to talk about. The previous week, it was my voice was gone, and then Matt's was the week before. And I feel like your voice has gone again, but mine has kind of come back. So maybe one day we'll synchronize and either have no voices or two perfect voices.
Maybe. I'm not going to hold my breath because I feel like I would die of asphyxiation if that happened.
I kind of wish when we have beautiful moments like that, I wish I still taught English in a class, because the best thing about teaching non-native speakers idioms is them ruining those idioms for the non-native speakers. And it's really funny when they actually start using them themselves as well. I do miss that.
Is that because they're all like wrong or used incorrectly 99.99% of the time?
It turns out one of the funniest things is when someone misuses an English idiom that you just know, because this language is weird and stupid, and you just know what certain things mean. And there's, when I teach it to them, I give them the idioms and a list of meanings, and they have to sort of jigsaw them together and then use them in a conversation, but they don't know what the right answer is yet. And honestly, I don't even try and hide my open laughter at them when they get it wrong. We're all friends in my classroom. But it's really weird what tickles you when you're entrenched in a native language. You don't really think about how, especially in English, how many stupid non-literal things we say like all the time, compared to the Japanese, who have like two or three that they whip out on special occasions. And English is like 90% idiomatic language, and the poor Japanese are like, what do you mean?
Yeah. My favorite thing about that kind of thing is that the meanings of them have evolved such that over time that some of our most popular idioms are actually used completely incorrectly, but the meaning has evolved that they are now. So like my favorite one of these is people say that blood is thicker than water. Mm-hmm. Which in its original definition means exactly the opposite of what you think it does.
What's because, the second line? Family, something, something, something is the second line, isn't it? I can't remember.
Well, it's the whole line is the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb, which means that like the relationships you form in battle are stronger than those of your familial ties. Like it's exactly the opposite meaning of what you think it means.
That's the problem these days. We can't use it correctly because we don't go running into battle. Like we've talked about this before. If you've never seen Matt before, imagine like what a Viking would actually look like if they worked in London Drugs. Like, you know, that dissonance of Matt, like 1,000 years ago, Matt would be leading like a score of battle-hardened veterans into battle, drinking the blood of his enemies. And there'd be whispers about him. Have you heard of Matthew? Yes, I hear he is 11 feet tall and eats trees. Yes, he is. And it's weird that we are evolved into this battle system. Like our human bodies are amazing, and hunter-gatherers are killers and hunters. And then we just watch like Netflix all the time. Like, so I feel like Wally may have predicted our next step in evolution there. But my favorite misquote of a famous thing is the customer is always right.
Which, yeah, but only in matters of taste. But, I know that one quite well from my 2 decades of customer service.
Mr. Selfridge was basically like, if they want to buy an ugly hat, you let them buy an ugly hat. It's got nothing to do with them knowing more than the expert they are talking to. But yeah, I'm sure you've experienced that a lot more than I have.
Yeah, well, I'm just glad to be out of it now, so it's fine.
Are we doing an English podcast? Because this is my wheelhouse now. We could talk about grammar next if you want.
I feel like we should definitely not do that, because we would just never stop. And we have two movies to talk about. So
the third conditional is the root of all human imagination. We could do that if you want.
I feel like that's a different podcast. We should put a pin in that for a different time.
Fine. What are we talking about this week, then?
Right. So we have two movies to talk about, and they're both from the Vancouver International Film Festival, which is on now. By the time you listen to this, it'll be the last day, but we will have, or at least I will have, a follow-up episode with some more recommendations later this week. So listen, tune in to the feed for that. Before we jump into these two, Simon, have you seen anything from the film festival other than these two movies? I know you're kind of pressed for time.
So I really tried. At the moment, it's our year end in work, and we have a big meeting on Friday, and I'm helping out our office admin person by collating a year's worth of Excel spreadsheets. And
that sounds awful.
So the short answer is I've watched maybe 10 minutes of The Grizzly Truth, and I would have loved to watch more of that because it just blows my mind how you can just have a team in a town. They're like, you know what? We're going to move to a different country. I'm from England. Can you imagine like Chelsea moving to Edinburgh? We're now like the Edinburgh Blues. Yeah, we moved from Chelsea. That's no big deal. Like, it just doesn't happen. And so I'm fascinated by that. But no, I watched like 10 minutes of that. I got, there's one that you sent me that I have to watch that is a guy in a giant orange suit that has had loads of great word of mouth. Like the branches of something, the branches of truth.
Anyway. Oh, the branches may be. Yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
Oh, God.
Name, now that you've asked me on the spot, I can't remember the name of it. But if that's the one I think it is, that what's it called? Until Branches Bend, I think.
Right. Yeah,
that actually just won an award, too. It's like best BC film, I think.
And I've heard great things about it. I haven't had time for that as well. These poor screener links are going by. I'm just not the person to review a film festival at the moment. But I watched these two because I've been sick from getting the vaccine. I got side effects again, which is fine. I welcome them with open hands and open arms for that good medicine. But I took a day off because I was feeling rough, so I literally just watched everything that we need to talk about today.
Nice. I watched a few more, not many, but a few more than you because I've also been quite busy. But I'll be doing, like I say, with myself and Dakota from our friend podcast, ContraZoom. We'll be doing a follow-up, like VIF wrap-up episode together. So listen in on the feed for that later this week, I think, where we talk about some of the films we've seen and liked. So for now,
when you speak to Dakota at ContraZoom, who are a wonderful bunch of people, please can you correct him, and it's actually Get Out, Us, and Nope 1, 2, 3. If you just mention that to him, that would be great. Thanks.
My favorite thing about this is that for those of you who don't know, we're in a group chat with a bunch of people, including the ContraZoom folks, We've all guested on each other's shows, except for Simon, who's never spoken to Dakota in his life.
Oh, no, I've never spoken to Dakota. I appeared on, God, help me, after the Oscars.
Oh, yeah, we spoke with the For Real crew after the Oscars.
For Real, that was so much fun. Yeah, so I would love to, but I'm not the person to guest pod on a post about a film festival I haven't seen anything of. So that's
awesome. Good. All right, well, let's dive into these two movies. First, we're going to talk about two movies, and one of which is a film Canadien called Viking, and the second one is a big international critical darling called Triangle of Sadness. But we are going to start with Viking because it's the smaller film, it's a Canadian film, and also one of us really didn't like it. And I'll pause you, dear listener, to guess which one of us that's going to be.
Matt, I'm going to ask you to do the summary of the plot, as it were, because I won't be able to do it with a straight face.
Yes, so Viking is a 2022 film directed by Stéphane Lefleur and starring Steve LaPlante and Lursa Corvo and Hamza Haq and a number of other people. And basically the plot is that I mean, I can't keep a straight face out. The plot is deliberately absurd.
No. Oh. Everything Everywhere All at Once is deliberately absurd. Please continue.
I mean, the idea of this movie is absurd. Basically, there's a mission to Mars happening, and the unnamed space agency, which is heavily implied to be NASA, but because this film is set in Quebec, it's not NASA, basically interviews a whole bunch of people and settles on a group of five that have very similar personalities to the Martian astronauts. And they set them up in a mock base because in the past, when they sent the Viking probes to Mars, they had duplicates in a lab and they were able to solve problems by having a duplicate that were happening on Mars. So they want a duplicate mission here on Earth so they can solve problems. So they've chosen five people who have very similar personalities to the Martian astronauts, so that they can like observe their group dynamic and see what happens. This is an absurd film, and I think it'll either work for you or not. I will say it's interesting. The range of reactions to this of the people I know who've seen it has gone from, spoiler alert, Simon's the one who hated it, but I also know someone who it's going to be like in their top three for the festival. So it's there for those of you who connect with it. I think we'll connect with it pretty hard. I thought it was fine. Simon, what did you think? I want to hear your perhaps slightly varnished opinion.
My problem with this is that all good sci-fi has an interesting idea that it then explores just at its basic level, right? And the idea of this is so stupid that no one who has ever been involved with any kind of people watching or manipulation would ever think it was ever going to work on any level. Like, it's such a stupid idea so it begins with like a yes or no question, or how do you feel about this kind of question. So they're trying to find these people who have similar temperaments to their crew, and it doesn't matter about gender. A couple of them are playing opposite gendered astronauts, but I'll get onto why that's also really stupid later. And then they lock them in this, like, they've just landed on Mars, and then they take the Earth crew and lock them in this like bunker in farmland somewhere, like prairie, and ask them to simulate the relationships on Mars to try and work out the problems they're having. So every day they're given a set of instructions, like, this is how you're feeling today. And they have a meeting and they talk to themselves about who is feeling what and who else it involves. And then they try and talk through that. And it's kind of a mixture of role players, the characters, but their real personalities come out as well. And I think the point of this movie is meant to highlight the unpredictability of the human spirit. Like, you can have two identical people act in two different ways. But the problem is that it's never believable. It doesn't start from a position where it could actually work. It's not one of those interesting movies where they've got a premise and you start seeing the pieces like fall apart. Like, one of my favorite books, they made it into a similarly good movie, a Sam Raimi movie called A Simple Plan, where two brothers and their stupid best friend find a bunch of money, and it's drug money. I think you've seen this, haven't you? They find a crash plan.
It's not exactly a one and done concept. I've seen that film, and I've seen
every film. Yeah, absolutely. It's done. That's exactly my point. Like, this is a great example for me. Is that it's the threads start falling apart because of human nature, and of course, in this movie, they are expecting outcomes that are similar or can be recommended to the outcomes in the Viking crew, under not only completely different environmental conditions, but also the relationships are not natural relationships because they're being told like one or two lines about what's going on. But also the film kind of begins with the idea that a man will react to something in the same way as a woman will, and vice versa, and to each other. And it's just so stupid from the beginning that it didn't work at all for me. And then, so I gave it a chance. I watched the whole thing. I paused it so many times because I was so bored with this movie, because it wasn't just a bad idea. It was told really blandly, and there's nobody to root for, because the main focus, the actor who plays the astronaut, John, turns out to be a terrible person anyway. And there's nobody to root for. There's no one to empathize with. There is a whole set of circumstances that happen that evolve, each of them less believable than the last. And it just ends in with some kind of what I think is emotional redemption for the main character. It doesn't work at all. Like, this movie from front to back, as I texted you, it's a stupid idea told blandly. And I think for me, that's the worst thing a movie can do, is make me feel nothing. And I just felt nothing watching this movie.
I find it so interesting how strongly you reacted to this movie.
You know what? Do you know, I mean, the movie's
like first things first, I fundamentally disagree that this is a science fiction film. This is just an absurd character drama. That's all it is. It happens to have the trappings of there's crossover in that, like, they're basically play acting at being a space crew. That doesn't make it science fiction. That makes it quirky character drama, like, at best.
Come on, dude. This fits in with science. They're pretending to be astronauts.
Pretending, exactly. There you go. They are in no way in a science fiction-y premise. They are just on Earth pretending. It's a whole thing.
They're pretending for, like, the astronauts' behavior, though, on Mars, and they're doing, like, simulated spacewalks and like Mars probes made out of dustbins. I don't know. I think the semantics of it. I think there's a crossover. It is a character drama with sci-fi framing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a bit
that's
of a
stretch. Why I hate that. I didn't need it to work because I thought it was a sci-fi. I thought it's central. Like, it could be any genre. Its central premise was stupid. And any movie
I also think this movie is the kind that asks you to sort of buy into something absurd from the get-go. And if you're not able to do that, and I'm not judging anyone who can't, because it is a very deliberately absurd idea that these five people could be observed as though they are the same five people on Mars in any context. But, like, buying into the movie believing that they could is all that is required. And I thought it was fine. I don't think it was an amazing film, but I thought it was fine. I thought that Steve LaPlante, who's playing John, was quite compelling to watch. I'm actually a big fan of Hamza Haq, who is a fairly... he actually won a Canadian Screen Award earlier this year. He's a Canadian actor of, I believe, Saudi descent.
Yeah, I've seen him in some stuff. I do like him.
Yeah, he's quite good. I love that it is unabashedly, like, even though they're, like, doing a mission for NASA, they have Christopher Heyerdahl, who, if you know who that is, like, he's, you know, the Canadian character actor at this point, comes in to be, like, this NASA high up and give a speech about how they want to... what was the three words he used? Simulation and comprehension and solution. Yeah, they want to simulate, comprehend, and solve all their problems. Mm-hmm. And I mean, idiot. Like, don't get me wrong; it's an absurd idea. I fully believe that there's going to be a lot of people in your camp where you're like, "This isn't absurd. This is stupid."
Yeah, but, it wasn't.
But if you can get on board with the absurdity, then there's definitely something there. I know there's people who will love this movie out there, and I feel like it's worth at least trying to see if you're one of those people.
I disagree that this is painting itself as an absurdist movie. If you're going to be an absurdist movie, then be directed and written that way. Like, if Spike Jonze had taken this and rewritten it and directed it, it would turn into something more absurdist. It's shot straight. There's no.
So this is actually, it's interesting because this is actually my main criticism of the movie. And I think I already letterboxed it. So if you really wanted to, you can go read that. But my main criticism of the movie is that it is either I can't tell if it's played too straight or just straight up not absurd enough to keep it from being great for me. Like, I liked it. Don't be wrong. It's a pretty solid, like, solid, straight up the middle. Like, it's missing that critical something that would make it an amazing film. But it's fine. It's fine. There's definitely, for those, and again, for those who will connect with it, I think it'll be a pretty easy connection. And I know at least one person who absolutely loved it. So I definitely think it's a film worth checking out. And I appreciate the big swing, if nothing else. But like, I totally get that it didn't work for you, like, at all.
Yeah, and, you're right. You're totally right. It did. If it's going to be absurd, it needed to be written and directed and go much further that way. And it could have worked as a pure absurdist, like, black humor thing. Absolutely. But it didn't go down that route at all. It is played too straight and it is not absurd enough. And so because it is played straight, it's just stupid. I'm so angry about this. I get angry at films when they don't.
This is why I asked for your slightly varnished opinion. I thought you might like just like gussy it up a little bit. Like,
it's really interesting to me because the films that make me truly angry are films like this. Like, the next film we're going to talk about didn't work for me either, but there's a lot I want to talk about because it made me feel something. This movie just made me feel nothing, right? Just nothing.
It is interesting. My long-standing position is that the worst movies are fine. They're fine. Like, a death knell for a movie isn't that it's... Like, we continue to talk about movies that are bad, and we continue to talk about movies that are great, but movies that are fine just sort of, like, disappear into the ether because they're fine. They're just fine. And I think this has... I think that this is either just interesting enough or just bad enough that I think people will talk about it through the end of the year, at least in Canadian circles. But ultimately, I think it's fine. I think it's fine. Mm-hmm. So, I'm super, super interesting that you didn't like Steve LaPlante. I thought he was really good in playing a character who is not really that sympathetic at all.
I don't hate his portrayal of the character. I hated the way the character was used in the film and the writing of the film and the direction of the film. Yeah. But he, as an, who is that the main guy? Is that the guy who played John you're talking about?
Yeah.
No, he was totally fine. And as the one kind of interesting thing I thought that they might expand on a bit more is that he's a high school teacher, and every teacher I know, including me, is guilty of bringing their teacher home with them and mm-hmm. using that teacher and expecting that power you get, especially in high school, where everyone has to do what you're told. It's really difficult to get out of that frame of mind when you then talk to, like, other people outside of class. So that was kind of, I thought the actor explored that avenue quite well, but unfortunately everything else that he had to do with it, just really, really hated.
Yeah. I do feel like maybe, Hamza Haq and another guy, Denis Houle, who played Liz, maybe understood what kind of movie they were in a little differently than everyone else. Because Denis Houle, who is like an older man, is an astronaut. He's the character he's playing in the film is Liz, who on the Mars mission is a young woman. And that dissonance, I think, he doesn't get enough screen time to really fully explore it, but he like goes all in, and it's at times it's quite funny. And Hamza Haq, who is also, you know, he's there, and I can't remember his deal of the like the Martian he's trying to like emulate, but it's funny because he's just not like at all. He's just like, I'm here now and it's me. Whereas like, where John thinks that he is emulating someone great, he's not, he's just being his normal asshole self. And, you know, the Liz character, takes it way too far. And then, yeah, like I say, I think there is stuff to talk about. I think there is, for the people who are going to connect with this film, it's going to be a great connection. And I am just barely not one of those people. Like, I really wanted to like this movie more than I did, would be a good way to put it.
sure. I want to like every movie. I want to love every movie.
I mean, yeah, that's a fair point.
You make a really interesting point about those two actors, and I think you're spot on. And if it had been written and directed better, I think it would have they would have really added to that aspect. I agree.
Yeah. Completely. All right. So how many stars for you? I'm going to give it a solid 3 out of 5.
Really?
Yeah. Again, I thought it was fine.
Yeah, it's one star for me. Like,
wow.
And that's I was actually, when thinking about how many stars I was going to give our next movie and compared to this one, and what I would usually, I think about what I take away, but with this movie I had to think about, where's that star coming from? And I had to, it took me, like, I don't think 0 stars exist, does it? But as an act of creation of art, which I want to recognize, one star just didn't
work. Wow. I appreciate your unvarnished honesty.
And yeah, I love absurdist movies. I love concept movies and things like Unraveling. And this just wasn't any of that for me. Didn't work at all.
Yeah. Alrighty, well, that is Viking, which I think is still playing. If you want to give it a try, I think you have one more. Actually, you know what? But no, by the time you read this, by the time you listen to this, it will have played almost certainly. It is playing on today. We're recording it Saturday, so yeah, it'll be over. But it'll be, honestly, this is produced in conjunction with Crave, so it'll be on a streaming service at some point.
Yeah, look forward to that. Oh, the astronaut, the spacesuit designs are good. There you go.
I actually really enjoyed their, at one point they're sent on a mission to like recover the original 70s Viking probe, and they're like, the mock-up that they recover is like a trash can with tripod legs on it. And, like, there's some fun ideas in this. Like, it's, like I say, I think the best way to describe it is that it's played a little too straight, or that it's not quite absurd enough. But anyway, let's move on to something a little maybe more or less divisive, depending on how you react, because we haven't talked about it, I think, at all, other than one scene, and that is the new Palme d'Or winning, that's right, it won the Cannes Film Festival, satire of wealth and privilege from Ruben Östlund, The Triangle of Sadness, which is, I think that people would benefit seeing this movie by going in as cold as possible. Because if we're going to talk about things being absurd and, or more specifically, uncomfortable, then the less you know, the better. And I can expand on that a little bit more once we get a little more deeper into talking about the film too. But Simon, why don't you give us a quick rundown on the plot, a spoiler-free rundown on the plot of Triangle of Sadness.
It's really interesting, actually, because I usually we talk about main characters going through the entire journey of a movie, and it certainly feels like in the first act we found our protagonists. We've got a male model. Oh, I forget his name. You probably know. Let me bring up the cast. A male model called Carl, who is going through the audition process of basically stripping down and having horrible, degrading questions asked of him. And as someone who is not through, obviously, male model auditioning, but I've done lots of auditioning, and it felt very, 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 very real, how awful that experience was for him. And then we meet his girlfriend, who is also a model, played by, unfortunately, the late Charlby Dean, who...
Charlby.
Who died really soon after the release of this movie. I know we'll talk about that
before. Before the release of the movie. Like, right before.
She's a model who turned to acting. She's fantastic in this. I mean, it's just an incredible loss.
Yeah, she's only 32, I believe.
Yeah. And so they're living the model high life, but bickering over money and things, and they decide to go, I'm skirting over a lot, but they decide to get away for a while, which is the second act, where they go on a luxury cruise and they meet they start off in absolute luxury with the we pan more onto the serving staff and their sort of boss, played by Vicky Berlin, prepping for making sure these rich people have an absolutely perfect cruise. And as someone who has just taken a 3-week cruise where an absolute army of well-dressed people attended to my every whim, it felt very, very real as well. And then things happen on the cruise, and I don't want to talk about the third act, although we're going to have to in kind of in part later, but it goes places. And the whole movie is really about privilege and power dynamics and how it corrupts. And it's a extremely political movie that absolutely does not skirt around what it's trying to say and will shock you into submission. And I don't mean like a horror movie. Now, this is a movie that is absurd. Ruben Östlund knows how to write and direct an absurd movie, and the actors are acting like it is. The movie didn't work completely for me, but technically, like, it is brilliantly shot. It is brilliantly written as well, put together, and as an absurdist movie. But buyer beware, this is a movie that is designed to make you feel uncomfortable. And I don't mean like, oh, I'm uncomfortable with my amassed wealth. I mean physically uncomfortable.
Which although, you say although that first thing as well.
Yeah, both. Absolutely both. And they are intrinsically connected. And there are a few moments that I actually had to, there's one moment in particular I had to fast forward through. I thought I was going to stop watching the movie. Oh, no, there's two moments because we talked about them both.
So, I mean, it's interesting to me because this movie is kind of like three movies in one. Each act is a different kind of movie. Yes. The first one is this character study of Carl setting up his relationship with Yaya. That's Harris Dickinson? Dickinson and Charlby Bean, and they are this couple, and she's kind of like, they're together, and he's like a puppy dog in love, and she's like, I don't know, you seem okay. The second act becomes this really interesting ensemble piece, and then the third act, and I don't want to spoil too much about it, but like every piece of marketing I've read says that there's a shipwreck. So there's a shipwreck, and the whole like social hierarchy of this luxury cruise is, so it's still an ensemble piece, but the dynamics shift very fundamentally.
Yes. It's Lord of the Flies for rich people, basically.
Yeah. And the rich people are all uniformly awful and hilarious.
Well, it turns out everyone's awful and hilarious, really. Given enough, like, rope, they will all hang themselves.
That is true.
And I think that's one of the strongest statements of the whole movie, is that you can, even with the best intentions, when you have privilege, we as a race cannot help but exploit that privilege. Even if we think we're doing it out of equity and equality, if we have privilege, there are others beneath us, and we will not let that privilege go.
I disagree, because at no point does anyone with any privilege in this film approach their privilege from anywhere other than a selfish place.
Yeah, that's what I mean, though.
Yeah.
But there's the... I really, really want to talk about one of the highlights of that, but it's a slight spoiler. But there is a... one of my favorite scenes in this movie, and probably my favorite scene actually, is a scene where the power dynamics shift openly. And
it is the scene where the power I think it's honestly, that is probably the best scene, not the most memorable, but definitely the best scene in the movie, is the scene in the beginning of the third act where the power dynamics fundamentally shift before your eyes. And a character who was basically a background character to this point becomes the most powerful person in the group. And it's amazing to watch.
Well done. Yeah, it's brilliantly done as well. And it's given, it's not rushed through, and it's given time. I mean, the one thing this movie does is give, it doesn't rush anything. It does. That's perhaps one negative that I have with it, is that it really, really wants you to focus on, if there's something it wants to tell you, it will show you that, and it will not pull away for a good long while. Where other movies might have made their point and moved on, this the director has chosen to focus on his point for longer than perhaps you would expect, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in and of itself might actually just be the point, though. Like, you don't get to look away from this, what's happening, right? Like, because that's as we so often do in, you know, our news media or just in real life, we look away from things and the movie doesn't let you. And that can be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But perhaps lead to some personal growth. I don't know.
So one of my criticisms why it didn't work for me is that the whole thing just felt really uneven, because
Feels like three different movies.
It does feel like three different movies that are connected sometimes quite tenuously through linking characters sort of floating from the front of one narrative to the back of another. And it wasn't a very satisfying way to watch or experience a movie for me. And I felt like it often was a bit self-indulgent in the points it was trying to make. And without naming a particular scene, there's a parallel with a Monty Python scene that makes very similar statement about wealth and opulence and the effects of wealth and opulence in exactly the same way. And the Monty Python scene is 3 minutes, and it is more effective than this scene that is a good 20, say, saying the same thing. And I felt like a lot of the movie did sort of made that mistake for me quite a lot, in that it the points that it was trying to make were obviously sometimes really, really stretched out, and I wanted the movie to progress. Like, I understood that point. It wasn't that I wanted to look away. It's like I understood what it was trying to say, and I just wanted the next thing. And some parts, because of that, I found a bit frustrating. And it's hard to sort of be any more specific without giving anything away. But
you're like, talking about the dinner scene, right?
I'm talking about the dinner scene, as in comparison to Monty Python. I'm also talking about the post-dinner scene with reading from Marx over the boat intercom. I'm talking there's quite a few moments in this movie that I just wanted, okay, you could now go to the next thing. I understand you've reached the peak of what you're doing here. And there's one point where, like, your wife tapped out of this movie that I was like, okay, I understand what's being done now. I don't need to see any more of this, please.
Yeah. There's definitely a whole sequence that I'm convinced that, so this film won the Palme d'Or, like it won the Cannes Film Festival, and I'm convinced it won that festival based on the scene that we're skirting around talking about. Mm-hmm. Because although it is quite long, I don't know if it's actually a full 20 minutes, like you say, but it certainly feels that way.
Because it's my lunch. Yeah, I get 30 minutes for lunch, and I watched it over my lunch, which was a stupid idea.
Yeah. But like, it is a perfectly, in my opinion, it's by far the most memorable scene in the movie, and it is a perfect execution of a long, slow ramp up of just, I mean, tension would be the wrong word, but like, basically there's two groups of people interacting in this dinner scene, like the people who are eating and the people who are serving them. And it's a good example of things going, actually what we talked about with Viking, it goes maybe a little too far in terms of how absurd it gets, but plays it in that, because it's so absurd, so straight, it works, and it's amazing, and it's disgusting. And it's my wife, who was, we were watching it, I was watching it, and my wife was feeling ill, and there was a certain point where she was like, I have to go.
Yeah, I think it should come with a warning, because there is a medical condition that if you watch someone vomit, you have a gag reflex. if you suffer from this, you should not go and watch this movie in a theater.
Or maybe
really,
at all.
Really, maybe at all. Maybe you shouldn't watch it at all, because even in the slightest bit, if you've ever noticed, oh, it's funny, when someone's sick, I feel a bit queasy. Like, don't watch this movie, because it doesn't just make its point. It revels in its point. And when you think it's gone as far as it's going to go,
it goes the director's further.
Like, no, that was stage one.
Yeah, and also it's interesting too, because I actually think that one of the funniest moments in the movie actually comes right before that. Like, it's at the very beginning of dinner, and I don't want to, I'm going to end up spoiling this joke, but there's this older couple who seem like the sweetest old couple in the world. They're called Clementine and Winston, and they're played by Amanda Walker and Oliver Ford Davies. I think his name is Davies. And they are, like, you've seen them in stuff. Like, you've definitely seen them in stuff before. She almost always plays a sweet old lady. And he's probably actually best known because he was in Star Wars. He's in the prequel trilogy. He's the, like, governor of Naboo.
Oh. It's that guy. Oh.
Yeah. But, like, at one point they're asked what they do. Like, they're obviously very wealthy and they're this sweet old couple. And then at one point they're asked what they do for a living. And he says that, like, oh, we're engaged in precision manufacturing. And everyone's like, of what? And he's like, well, you know, our products have been represented and reinforced democracies around the world. And it just goes to, like, exactly where, like, the, like, they're revealed to be the worst, maybe the worst people on the boat, but their plaids is, like, such a sweet old, like, church going, like, they're the kind of people who, like, stay behind a church to talk to the vicar, you know, like,
yeah,
in some 70s British comedy, and they're so lovely, but it turns out they're just awful human beings. And that whole conversation, I swear to God, is like, I lost my shit laughing at that scene, because it's played so perfectly.
And he's
and
like,
I don't want to spoil any more of it, but yeah.
And they banned the landmines that took out 25% of our profit, but we pulled through. And it's actually really, really sweet. It's a hand, and like, it's that contrast between a really sweet old couple talking about how they struggle through the landmine banning crisis in the EU, because that's what they're like.
Yeah, that scene might have been the funniest scene in the movie to me. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say, like, I find your criticism that it was sort of a little too long, a little too indulgent, interesting. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it is long and it is indulgent, but I think that's the point. For me, I was fully ready at the end of the second act to give this movie a full 5 stars.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
But interestingly, a big part of that for me is that there's a very long stretch of this movie where I watch a lot of movies, and my wife will tell you that she hates me for this, but, like, there's a lot of the time we'll be watching a movie, and if she's like, what do you think is going to happen next? She'll be like, wait, don't tell me. Because probably speaking, what you tell me will be what happens. And there's a long stretch of this movie.
Yeah,
there's a long stretch of this movie where I had no idea what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Like, legitimately, I was like, I have no idea. This is a roller coaster. I have no idea where it's going to go. And I legitimately love it for that. Like, there's no way to predict what was going to happen. Like, I'm not going to delineate it for you, the listener, because it'll be a spoiler, but there's a long stretch from where I just had no idea what was going to happen. And then there's a moment in the third act where I was just like, oh, this is how it's going to end. And it was a little bit too far away from the end for me. There's definitely a moment where I was like, okay, I know what's going to happen now. And the end of that roller coaster and I know that you loved the ending, as I understand. And I don't want to say that the ending is bad, but if the movie had been able to maintain that unpredictability, I think I would have legitimately loved it and thought it was one of the best movies of the year. But because there's a moment where I was like, and the rest of the plot falls into place, I can stop watching now.
But it's interesting that whenever I work out that ending, and I don't get any displeasure from working that out than seeing it happen. Like, if you predict an ending, do you lose some of the pleasure of it?
Well, actually, it's not the prediction of it. It's that for a long time, I thought I wasn't going to be able to.
Oh, okay.
Right? So it's not the ending itself. The ending itself is kind of the only ending that makes sense for the story. Yeah. And I guess that is kind of like criticizing myself, but like I was hoping for something that I wasn't going to be able to predict because there's such a long stretch where I legitimately wasn't going to be able to tell you what happened next. As soon as I was able to again, I was like, oh, and I know that's like a me thing. And it's just, you know, I think it's a thing that probably happens to lots of people like you and I who watch a ton of movies. You just sort of get to know how movies just work.
Something new. Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, if the movie had stayed in a place where it was just as absurd, but I could have told you what was going to happen the whole way through, I think I would have liked it more, but because it was so wildly unpredictable in that middle segment, being able to come, like bringing it back to a place where I knew it was going to happen was a little bit frustrating for me. And I know that that's a very specific and me-centric way to think about art, but folks.
It's completely subjective, so it's always through your own frame, isn't it? And this is why I liked it more, I think, because I love Lord of the Flies is one of the books I studied very young studying English literature, and it's the kind of story that I love, the dynamics of shifting power and changing situations. And in this movie, the central performance of the character who is involved in these power dynamics is an actress called Dolly D. Leon, who played Abigail, and I thought she was just amazing.
Compared to
the other actors who were really sort of dialed up to the absurdity, she was just this knife cool. Like when she moves through that third act, she's fantastic. Yeah. And so that the framing of the very end, when you realize what's at stake for her, when the end rolls into view, and it's never really answered, but what you suspect is going through her mind and her focus and intensity, that was a massive reason why I loved those two scenes, because of her performance. Sorry, you were going to say?
I was going to say that, like, again, first off, again, I think that the ending is good. Like, my ability to predict it aside, the ending is good and makes a lot of sense for the story that they're trying to tell. What I was going to say, though, is that, like, earlier, she has gotten so much word of mouth and so much praise for this film that earlier versions of the poster, her name wasn't on. And the most recent versions of the poster, her name is, like, billed, like, third. It's really interesting and really great because she is legitimately amazing in the film. And even though, like, it's debatable how much of the film she's even in, but she's so good in the parts where she's central that, I sincerely hope that she's like the, you know, every year at all the big award shows, there's always one person who you're like, oh, we're going to recognize this person who otherwise would never has been, even though they've been working steadily for their entire lives.
Yeah.
And I kind of hope that it's her this year.
I wonder if she wasn't put on the poster to not bring her to the forefront, so you're not watching out for her. Because one of the pleasures of this is seeing this background, very much a background person. And I quite like to rewatch Triangle, actually, to see how much of the rest of the movie she's in the second act. Because I wonder if one of the things the director is showing us is that she was there all along and we never even looked at her because she was one of the toilet cleaners. And we're looking
She's definitely there the whole time.
I get a feeling she's in a lot more of this movie than we realize, and that's kind of the point when she comes to the forefront. But she was phenomenal.
It definitely is, because if I remember correctly, there's only two of the help staff who have any lines, one of which is the manager, who's played by Vicky Berlin, and then there's one scene at the very beginning of the second act where a cleaning woman comes to the door, and it's her. Yeah.
Is that her? Oh, yeah. Perfect. Oh, that is perfect. It's, right.
And I feel like we're talking about the movie in more depth than I would like. Because again, like it's hard not to, though. Like there's the bottom line is I think you should see this movie.
We're not really talking about anything that isn't in the marketing, and you should definitely see this movie because of it's very singular in its vision. It is unlike the normal kind of three act following the same protagonist kind of westernized story that we're more used to. It is a, like you said, three different stories with almost like three different ensembles rolled into one, but all kind of linked together thematically. And it goes places, and you may be uncomfortable that you can't, uncomfortable enough not to watch it at a certain point. In fact, it wasn't the dining scene. I think after having two kids, that stuff doesn't trigger me anymore. Like, I've seen so much. Like, I've just seen everything at this point. It was, there's a scene in the, oh, I don't even want to, like a scene in the jungle later.
I think I know the scene you're talking about.
I actually had to fast forward through. It was, and it's not because it's bad, because the reaction, something horrific happens, and the group of people are cheering. And it's that, you know, it's very precise. Everything in this movie is so precise. Like, there is not a wasted moment in this film to make the point. Like, it's directed really, really well. It's written really, really well. But it's, I couldn't watch it. I literally had to fast forward through it because it just wasn't awful.
Yeah.
And so you may have that reaction. I think some people will leave during the dining scene. I predict that will have people walking out.
Yeah. Well, how many stars will you give The Triangle of Sadness out of 5, Simon?
I thought about this a lot. And I've tried to be more positive about it because it is an interesting film to watch. It is very good technically. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work for me as a whole. It wasn't cohesive enough as a single movie, and I thought it was a bit overindulgent at quite a lot of times. It's quite overindulgent, and it's a 2-star movie from me.
Interesting. That's lower than I was going to guess you were going to put it at.
Mm-hmm. What's yours?
It's 4. It's 4 out of 5. I mean, I would give it 4 out of 5 just based on there's two, the dining scene and one other scene. I basically would make it a 4. For me, that plus the performances in general, I really like this movie, and it's interesting because sometimes you watch The Critical Darling and it's a difficult watch, and you're like, oh, I don't get it, but this is one of the ones where I was like, nope, yeah, no, I get it, I get why. This is definitely not going to connect for everyone, but it connected for me. Yeah.
And it's a worthy winner of the Palme d'Or. Like, this is one of those films. Like, it didn't work for me, but I can see why it won, and I accept that decision. Like, if Viking had won, we'd have a different discussion. But it is, it's going to work for a lot of people, and as a filmmaking experience being the operative word, there's really not much else like it at the moment, and it doesn't hide its message at all. There's no subtlety in this movie. Maybe it could have afforded to be a bit more subtle. I don't know, but there is no nuance here. It is.
I think it would have dulled its impact had it chosen to go that route.
That's certainly true.
Yeah. How was it for you seeing your former co-star Zlatko Burek on screen?
I don't remember. I don't believe I did any scenes with Zlatko Burek. I don't even remember him in 2012. It's such a memorable movie.
I mean, he's the Russian billionaire. He's amazing in 2012.
He's a Russian billionaire, and this is not.
For those of you who don't know, I unabashedly love the 2009 movie 2012, and Simon was in the 2009 movie 2012.
You can see me acting and everything. It's fantastic.
Yeah, capital A acting. It's pretty great.
Also, my position was I steered the boat, and if you remember that highly realistic scene where they avoid Mount Everest in the wave, that's literally because of me. So everyone survived because of me. You're welcome. And then I had to stand next to John Cusack for 7 hours and keep my shit together, which was very difficult.
Don't they crash into the mountain? I'm pretty sure they crash into the mountain, dude. You crashed them in.
No, they go around the mountain. If they crashed into the mountain, we'd all be dead. short, they steer and they kind of glance it instead of hitting it dead on. So, you know, I did my best.
Sure, yeah, sure. I'll give you this one. That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. So Triangle of Sadness is actually, if you're listening to this when we first release it on Sunday morning, you will have one more chance to see Triangle of Sadness in a theater. It is playing as part of the film festival, Vancouver International Film Festival, at the Center for the Performing Arts at 9 p.m. on Sunday, October 9th, which is the night of the day that we're releasing this episode. So if you're listening to it first thing, you have a chance.
I will say, yeah, I imagine this movie is really enhanced by a group of people.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get, when it's just you at home going, oh my fucking God. When there's like 200 people in the room going, oh my fucking God. Like it's really, I think it's really going to help.
That's a fair point. I think a group experience of this film might be not integral, but enhancing of the experience of the film. And also just to look around and see how people are reacting to perhaps being called out a little bit by the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Good. We're going to call it there. I don't know what we're going to be watching next week, but like I say, we should have at least one bonus film festival episode on the feed, hopefully this week. So I'll have to work out the timing on that. Thank you so much to everyone who's listening. It seems like we have a few new listeners again this week. Always nice to see that, and welcome. And we hope you stick around. We love all of you. If you like what you heard, or if you'd like to support us, we would love if you would give us a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Tell your friends, tell your loved ones, tell people you don't like. I don't know, just tell everybody. And if you'd like to support us a little more directly, we do have a Patreon and a Ko-fi, and they are both linked in the show notes. You can find us on the social medias. You can find us on Twitters at AwesomeFridayCA. You can find me at SmatthewAF. You can find him at TemporaryPen. And we are on other platforms as well, but that's the main one we use. We record this here in Vancouver, BC, on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish Nations. And we would like to say thank you very much for joining us on this awesome Friday.
Bye.